Hi, everyone. I'm Jackie Goldschneider from The Real Housewives of New Jersey.
And I'm Jennifer Fessler, also from The Real Housewives of New Jersey.
Welcome to our new podcast,
Two Jersey J's.
We are going to have lots of fun on this podcast while we discuss what it's really like to be a real housewife and all the drama that comes with it.
Follow us as we navigate family, friendships, and even frenemies. Listen to Two Jersey J's on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Rachel Levis, host of the new podcast, Rachel Goes Rogue. This podcast is about choosing my own path and standing in my power. I have been involved with one of the biggest scandals in reality television history. We're going to get into all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly. I've been keeping secrets for far too long, and I just want to come clean. Listen to Rachel Goes Rogue on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
May 14th, 1992 started as a normal Thursday for Eron Shellman. He called up a few of his buddies to hang, Andre, Floyd, and Antonio. Floyd came by in his car and they all headed out to get haircuts, pick up some liquor, and bounce around Detroit.
We had fun, we laughed, we joked. All of those things happened.
Eron was driving Floyd's car with Antonio beside him in the passenger seat and Floyd and Andre in the back. Suddenly, he heard a loud bang.
And it startled me to a degree where I almost crashed the car. And as I was trying to stop the car and gain that back, Antonio leaned over and fell into my lap. I had my dearest friend laying in my lap, bleeding out the back of his head.
Antonio was dead. The man who shot him confessed to police and gave a full statement.
And he said, you know, I just lost it. I didn't even think about it. I just took the gun. I just shot him.
But Eron was arrested, charged, and tried for his murder. And in the end, Eron was the one who was convicted.
I'm Eron Shellman. I've served 30 years, 9 months in prison for first-degree murder that I didn't do.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Eron Shellman. Eron Shellman was born in Detroit in 1972.
Yeah, I grew up on the inner city, Detroit, Michigan. Mother was Desiree Shellman, and my father was Theodore Wright. My mother did a bunch of stuff early on. She worked at AT&T for a spell, and she worked at Blue Cross and Blue Shield for a spell. My father was in and out of correctional facilities.
So your mom pretty much raised you by herself?
Yeah, with a handful of cousins and family members and stuff that, you know, also participated in the rearing of me. I have one sibling. She's 10 years younger than I am. I have a host of cousins. They all think that they're my brothers and sisters.
How would you describe Eron?
Overall, I would say, if I had to give it words, gentle giant, right?
This is Eron's cousin, Sonia Shellman. She's 9 years younger than Eron.
Sometimes when you see people who are larger in stature, you have a sense of intimidation, and that has never been that with him, because he's always had a very soft voice. And so his words always came out really soft and graceful and kind. But when it was time to be protective, you could hear change, right? Don't do that. Put that down. You're going to get in trouble. You know, those sorts of things. Growing up, it was just like that. So because we have a small yet close-knit family, everyone operated in a way that felt in a protective measure sort of way. So the older cousins or, you know, of that nature hovered over all of the younger ones, such as myself, in a way that felt very brotherly and sisterly.
Yeah, my grandfather, you know, he would give us a few dollars every weekend and we would all pile into city bus and catch the bus downtown and watch Kung Fu movies when we were children.
What movies? Do you remember?
Oh, we watched all of the Kung Fu movies at Fox, you know, when we were kids, like late 70s, early 80s. It was fans of the guys with the rings.
Bruce Lee, that's who it was, right? Okay.
Yes, okay. There you go.
Although his extended family was always there for him, Eron's home life was unstable.
You know, again, I was pretty young, but, you know, all signs showed that, you know, it was drug abuse and those types of things that were happening in the home.
Eron spent less and less time at home, more and more time out in the streets. Before long, he was starting to get in trouble.
You know, typical story as the household deteriorates and, you know, there's no real person that's making you do this or making you do that, you know, so you tend to start running with people that you shouldn't.
And so what was that in your neighborhood? What was going on?
It was a lot. It just was. It was, you know, guys that did this and guys that did that. Drug dealing, you know, breaking in houses. I was away a lot, you know, juvenile delinquency, youth homes, training schools and such.
How much of your childhood do you think you spent in some sort of facility or incarceration?
I'm 51 years old. And last I tried to do the math, I think I may have spent maybe 14 years free.
Do you think growing up with your dad in prison had any effect on how you kind of chose to live your life?
Must have, right? Like, you know, like my grandfather, he chipped in. He did the best he could. He worked a lot and such, but he come by every day and check on me and spend a few minutes with me a day. But for a child like me and, you know, that was going through all that type of family drama, kind of want a strong individual. You long for a father figure, right? To teach you, you know, what not to do and what to do.
So you have these friends, you're kind of living this little bit of street life, getting into some trouble. Can you tell me about your relationship with Andre Rice and Antonio Knight?
Both of them was real, real good friends of mine personally. Like we grew up as like really, really good friends. At those ages, at the 13 and the 14, I lived on a street with Antonio from the age of 12, 13. We caught the same bus to school for like many years. I spent nights over their house. I ate at their house, you know, when my mother was kind of going through her things, you know. And we weren't guaranteed to have a home-cooked meal there. I would go over Antonio's house and his mother, Darlene, and his kind grandmother and them, they would feed me all the time.
What was Antonio like?
Early on, he was like us, pretty much, you know, kid trying to find his way, right? Trying to figure out which side of the tracks he's going to fall on, you know. And as I would come back to the neighborhood as I was released from this facility or I would get a break from that foster home, I seen the change in it, it shift. It was never really wholesome, but it stopped being that and more street.
And then tell me about Andre. You said you were really close with him.
Yeah, he was kind of like a kid brother. You know, we would go out and dance and like little light partying and such, you know. Nothing really crazy, but, you know, he went to school every day and he had a strong mother influence.
Oh, really?
Wouldn't allow him. She was really, you know, big with church and, you know, and that type of stuff. So she really wouldn't let him veer off too much.
In May of 1992, Eron was 19 years old. He was still hanging out with Andre and Antonio, who also went by the name Tone, as well as some of the other neighborhood guys. One Thursday morning, Eron decided he needed a haircut, and Tone wanted to come along. Eron called up his friend Ken, who ran a barbershop at his house, and Ken said, sure, come on by.
So we called Floyd, which was my buddy, you know what I'm saying, and he would drive us. And so he pulled up and picked me up, and we started to accumulate more and more people.
Eron, Floyd Pennington, and Andre headed over to Antonio's to pick him up, and Eron went inside to get him. While he waited, he chatted with Tone's grandmother and little sister.
It was really just me being goofy with the kid's sister, and grandmother said something or another to me, you know, y'all be careful, y'all, you know, stay out of trouble. You know, she was big on that type of.
The four of them went over to Ken's and got haircuts, then drove around in Floyd's Dodge for most of the day.
I don't recall who was sitting where first, but I drove because I didn't drink as much as them. Throughout the day, there was shifting in the seats. We made a couple of stops, including like liquor stores, the barbershop, something to eat.
And they did at one point stop at Montez Bell's house. So that's Eron's cousin. They stopped there and chatted for a couple of minutes.
This is Rachel Wolf, Eron's post-conviction attorney.
Montez said at this time, like, hey guys, like, what are you doing? Like, where are you going? And that's when Eron apparently said, we're going to take Tone out, or we're going to take Tone out.
At some point that day, Andre and Antonio may have gotten into some kind of disagreement, but if there was anything wrong between them, Eron was unaware of it.
I was in and out of a car, going in and out of cousin's house, talk to him, back in. So I don't know the full between those two. When we traveled back up towards Antonio's house, it was kind of quiet from Andre, but everyone else was still in the mode that they were in. We laugh, we joke, you know, all of those things happened.
Eron was driving with Antonio in the passenger seat beside him. Floyd was sitting in the back seat behind Tone, and Andre was sitting behind Eron. Suddenly, out of nowhere, Eron heard a loud bang.
And it startled me to a degree where I almost crashed the car. And as I was trying to stop the car and gain that back, Antonio leaned over and fell into my lap. I looked back. I seen the faces of Floyd and Andre, and I had my dearest friend laying in my lap, bleeding out the back of his head.
Do you remember if anyone was like, what the hell just happened? Like, what did you do?
I don't know if anyone really screamed out. I really don't. I think it was, what now, right? I think that's the emotion. What now? Like, you know, what to do? What happens now, right?
So what did you do?
I drove. I stopped here. I stopped there. And before long, we were in an alley, maybe 2-3 blocks away. They told me to stop. The gun was still in his hand. You know, it was pull over here, stop the car.
Andre and Floyd pulled Antonio's body out of the car and left it there in the alley. And then Eron drove.
I was just so scared, you know. I didn't want to be the one that was labeled the snitch or any of that.
So they found the body in the alleyway. I believe somebody who ran a shop nearby in the area found the body in the alley and called the police.
An autopsy showed that Tone had died of a single gunshot wound to the back of his head. Almost immediately, the Detroit police were out looking for the killer, and a number of suspects were rounded up for questioning.
I do know that they arrested at least 3 people who were, you know, maybe witnesses. They suspected that these 3 individuals, it's Montez Bell and then this other woman, Barbara Meyer, and her boyfriend, William Logan, were all arrested, charged with the homicide, and then held for many hours before they ultimately gave statements. I don't know exactly how Eron and Andre initially became suspects, but I can wager a guess that they spoke to Antonio Knight's grandmother, who ultimately did come in and testify at trial because she had seen these four men in the car together hours before Tone died.
A few weeks later, Andre Rice was arrested as well. Eron was still laying low.
You know, I'm 19 years old. I'm ducking in the Dodge. And I only really came out once I found out that they had arrested Andre. So I kind of let my guard down after that. I'm like, oh, okay. Police arrested him. Like, you know, it's over with, right?
But it wasn't over. The statements from Montez, William, and Barbara, along with Tone's grandmother, had placed Eron in the car when Tone was shot, and the investigation was now focused on him and Andre. Before long, the police found him at his cousin's house and took him down to the station.
I didn't speak to him. They took me back to the cell for hours. When I come back down, they had a confession from Andre. That's what he told me. He showed me a paper with a signature on it and said he had everything he needed. And I said, well, if you got everything you need and you got a confession, surely I can go, right? Wasn't the case. They said they needed me to put some nails in the coffin of him and to pull Floyd into it. I said, I don't know nothing.
On June 13th, 1992, Andre Rice confessed to shooting Antonio. He told the police that Eron and Floyd had no idea it was going to happen, and they had nothing to do with it.
What Andre says is that Tone had been threatening him and threatening his family. And so Andre says he had been drinking, and he said he was sitting there and thinking, this guy's going to hurt my family. It's totally unprovoked, you know. I just lost it. I didn't even think about it. I just took the gun. I just shot him.
So you stay quiet. He confesses. How do you think you got involved in this?
I was tied to it either way, right? So I just assumed that since I didn't help anybody and I didn't help the investigation, I would be thrown in somehow, right? That's what I was thinking. I don't know, you know, at the time, I surely didn't think that it would garner me a first degree murder conviction and send me away for 30 plus years.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hi, I'm John O'Brien, host of Money and Wealth on the Black Effect Podcast Network. I'm an entrepreneur and a businessman, some would call a thought leader. Now, every Thursday, my newest venture is educating you on how to win financially. Even better, I'm going to teach it in a way that, well, you can understand. No unexplained theories, no mundane lessons, no using 20 words when two will do. I'm going to meet you where you are and take you where you need to be. I'm giving you straight talk, relatable stories, and life lessons through my own experiences and the lens of others. We're not just talking about why financial freedom is important. We're focusing on how you can achieve it too. We all might have different starting points and end goals, but as long as we have the desire to acquire financial freedom, it can be done from the streets to the suites. Listen to Money and Wealth with John Hope Bryant every Thursday on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jackie Goldschneider from The Real Housewives of New Jersey. I joined the show in season 9.
And I'm Jennifer Fessler, also from The Real Housewives of New Jersey. I joined the show in season 13.
And we host the new podcast,
Two Jersey J's.
You know us from The Real Housewives of New Jersey, and now you'll really get to know us.
We're going to tell you probably more than you want to know. We are going to have lots of fun on this podcast while we discuss what it's really like to be a real housewife and all the drama that comes with it.
Follow us as we navigate family, friendships, and even frenemies.
And we're going to be brutally honest about motherhood, men, menopause, and making every day count.
Listen to Two Jersey J's on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Sue. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On June 17th, 1992, Iran Shelman and Andre Rice were both charged with first-degree premeditated murder. Their trial started 6 months later.
The trial was actually pretty short. It ran over the course of 5 days, December 17th through the 23rd of 1992. They were tried together, Andre and Iran, but they had separate juries.
The judge was Vera Massey Jones, and the prosecutor was Lisa Lindsay. Iran's defense attorney was Paul Curtis, and Andre's attorney was Jeffrey Edison.
He was partners with Paul Curtis. They were law partners. They were operating out of the same office. There is a potential conflict of interest there.
But the trial moved forward with very little to go on. There was no physical evidence for the state to present.
They never found a murder weapon in the case. According to the police, they never found the car. Floyd went away with the car. The car was never seen again, so they couldn't fingerprint it or do anything like that.
The prosecution's few witnesses included a medical examiner and one of the police officers.
And then there was Antonio Knight's grandmother came in and testified about what had happened when they came to pick Antonio up that day and what she saw. There were three people in the vehicle. Well, four if you count Antonio himself. One of them was never charged, never arrested, never interviewed.
That was Floyd Pennington, the owner of the car.
He was the one white man in the car, which I also find interesting. You know, so their only evidence that Iran was guilty was this testimony of his cousin.
Montez Bell was the state's star witness. He was the one who said Iran had told him they were going to take Tone out.
He was the one that was going to make a difference. And his testimony was incredible. There were lots of ways to impeach him and discredit him, just using conflicts in his own testimony, conflicts between what he said at trial and at the exam, the fact that he had charges pending, the fact that he was facing the homicide charge initially. So he just... The trial attorney really just focused on cross-examination.
Did the police convince anyone to testify against him that maybe made something up?
I don't know. I will say that one of the investigators on the case, her name was Barbara Simon, has been alleged in several other cases of, you know, pressuring witnesses, eliciting fabricated testimony. So it's possible, and especially knowing what we do about the Detroit Police Department at that time, it's possible. Barbara Meyer said straight up that she gave them seven different statements and they would not release her until she gave the one that they wanted her to. And she said at that point, I would have done anything to get out of there. It's one of the worst places I've ever been. And I hear that a lot.
Now, to understand what happened next, it's important to know how the trial was conducted. Iran and Andre were co-defendants, and they were tried together before the same judge and prosecutor. but they had two separate defense attorneys and two separate juries.
So the way they do that is, you know, they'll do partial testimony from one witness. They'll present the things in front of each jury while the other jury is out of the courtroom. And anything that pertains to both cases, they'll have both juries in the courtroom. It's something they do a lot to save time.
This means that potentially each jury could get a very different picture of the same set of events.
Andre didn't testify at the trial, but they had a police officer take the stand and read his initial statement into the record. This is the very first version of events he told police. You know, he went in there, they interviewed him. He said, "We were all in the car. I shot him. The other two people in the car with me didn't know anything about it. I didn't even think about it. I just acted," right? That same evidence was not presented to Mr. Shellman's jury ever.
He was convicted first. He was charged with first-degree murder and felony firearm. They reduced his to second-degree murder with felony firearm, and they just left me at first-degree murder.
And in this case, Andre, I believe, got 25 to 60 years was his sentence.
I'm just still wondering how that happened, because isn't it true that Andre also said, like, you were not involved, you didn't know anything?
But that information was never read in my trial. The jury never heard that. The jury only heard that I was a bad kid and that I went and picked my buddy up and something terrible happened to him. If you only hear a certain side, it's all you can make your opinion. And so I don't blame him at all.
So because the jury had not heard the evidence that allowed Andre Rice's jury to say, oh, there was no premeditation and deliberation, Eron Shellman's jury did not have any idea. They didn't hear Andre's statement. So if they believed that he was involved even in the slightest, they believed they were looking at something that was a first-degree homicide. That's the charge that was put to them, right? And they found him guilty of it. In Michigan, if you're convicted of homicide, either as the principal or as an aider and abettor, there is a mandatory life without parole sentence. And you're going to die. You're going to die in prison. It means life in Michigan.
So Rice got a lesser sentence. I know that you explained a little bit of that because of the testimony that was not allowed into Eron's trial, but that was not a Brady violation, correct? It was not hidden. The defense attorney just did not.
The defense attorney knew about it, you know, and it's, I don't know, you know, we interviewed Paul Curtis. We called him at the evidentiary hearing to explain his reasoning. And the only reason he gave was that he assumed Andre Rice would plead the fifth and just refuse to testify. And so what was the point of talking to him? And when I asked him, well, why wouldn't you use this statement? You didn't need Andre. He really didn't have an answer.
When you're sitting at trial and they present this for Andre and then not for you, did you say to your defense attorney, like, what is going on? Why isn't this coming into my trial?
I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue. No. 19-year-old, no. I really believed that, like, someone would see the truth, right? That's what you hope, right? You hope that, like, hey, like, you know, you got me down for a murder. I don't have a gun possession to nothing. It's just a murder, right? And you have the other guy down for the murder and the gun, and you assuming that, like, someone will say, like, what was his involvement then, right? You know, so it just didn't happen for me.
Hi, I'm Sarah Jakes Roberts, host of Woman Evolve podcast. You may also know me as a pastor, author, wife, mother, businesswoman, and leader. Women are shattering glass ceilings that once limited their ability to dream, grow, and change the world. Well, as the definition of womanhood continues to advance, so does the woman's need to connect and assess where she fits in this ever-changing world around her. No longer do women have to choose between family or career, sis, you can have it all. You're already Superwoman on your own, but imagine how transformative things could be if you allowed yourself the opportunity to embrace sisterhood. Well, over here, we encourage each other. We hold each other accountable. We teach each other, and we cast out the spirit of shame. Through honest conversations, sermons, and interviews with other dynamic women, my goal is to empower women around the world to elevate to the best versions of themselves. So girl, get up and listen to the Woman Evolve podcast every Wednesday on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Rachel, and this is my new podcast, Rachel Goes Rogue. You think you know me because you've seen and heard the stories. I was most recently involved in one of the biggest reality TV scandals, coined Scandoval. I'm ready to divulge the details, and you may be shocked by what you hear. I'm here to tell my story, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I've made some terrible decisions, but I continue to learn and grow. I've chosen to protect others by keeping secrets for far too long, and I'm ready to come clean. I've taken some time away to reflect on my actions, and I'm finally in a place where I can share what I've discovered about myself and some of the tools that I've learned. As I tell my story, I will bring on guests who have knowledge and expertise on a variety of topics. Listen to Rachel Goes Rogue on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jackie Goldschneider from The Real Housewives of New Jersey. I joined the show in season 9.
And I'm Jennifer Fessler, also from The Real Housewives of New Jersey. I joined the show in season 13.
And we host the new podcast,
Two Jersey J's.
You know us from The Real Housewives of New Jersey, and now you'll really get to know us.
We're going to tell you probably more than you want to know. We are going to have lots of fun on this podcast while we discuss what it's really like to be a real housewife and all the drama that comes with it.
Follow us as we navigate family, friendships, and even frenemies.
And we're going to be brutally honest about motherhood, men, menopause, and making every day count.
Listen to Two Jersey J's on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Prison is like a microcosm of like the worst of the worst. That's what I think prison is. It's, you know, you got your elements that's really bad and terrible. And then you got maybe a little bit of a scintilla of goodness, right? And it's up to you which side you want to, you know, attach yourself to. When you go to prison, the older guys will tell you it's sheep and it's wolves in here. Which one you want to be, right? So, you know, 19, 20 years old. I was 20 by the time I was sentenced. I was 20 years old. I'm in prison. I have a life sentence. So I didn't make the best decisions early on, right? I fought a lot. I wanted to prove myself a lot. I found myself in those head spaces, right?
Sonia was just 10 years old when her beloved cousin Eron, the gentle giant who watched over her, went to prison.
It was a milestone, not in a good way, for our family. The impact was felt through the entire family unit, and it was visceral. You could see it. People changed, things changed. It was a loss. It was a grief and loss experience for the family.
And, you know, he mentioned, we talked about how he was in and out of some foster homes, juvenile detention. Mm-hmm. He got in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. When he gets charged with murder, was that surprising to everyone?
It was. He was 19 when he went to prison, right? There were teenage things, you know, joyriding or, you know, running away from home, or we can't find you for a week because you're hiding with a lady or a girl or whatever, you know. You never heard of violence. not from the gentle giant, right? So that was a major shock to our family.
Did everyone believe in his innocence at first, or was there, yes, everyone did?
Yes, that was, wow, it was clear because we know him. We know him. So part of that grief and loss also included that charge, and persons were not able to articulate what that meant and how we disagreed or how we couldn't even imagine something like that could happen. We didn't have the skill set. The adults lost their ability to rationally behave emotionally. You saw lots of crying and anger and who missed court and who went to court and who should be finding money and what should we be doing. It became a different family dynamic altogether. How do you pay for this? What do you do? Where do we go? That shift was painful to watch.
Wow.
After the initial shock, the family rallied together to support Eron. And as Sonia grew older, she took on more of a role in his fight for innocence.
Our relationship began to get very strong in my teen years. And so I would ask him questions and he would say things like, "You smart enough to handle this." And so he would like tell me what he was doing in appeals and send me what he had and I would read it. And so I knew early on about the confession, yeah.
So at what point did things start to change for you in prison? Do you remember when that was?
My last like 17, 18 years were without incident, right? In fact, my last 11 years and 3 months, I was a member of the TGIE dog program where I helped train rescue greyhounds.
Wow.
So I did that, but it allowed me time to really get back into my case and research some other avenues of my case. And that's what we did. Me and a fellow inmate, you know, we started going back through it and kind of looking at it from a different vantage point. And we kind of stumbled up on a couple of things.
So he filed his post-conviction motion for relief from judgment in 2017. He had written it himself, and maybe he had the help of a legal writer or something. He had written it. They held his case, it's called in abeyance. The judge didn't decide it. They referred it to the Wayne County Conviction Integrity Unit. That's the prosecutor's office's own division to review these cases.
Around that time, Eron heard about Rachel from a fellow prisoner. And he reached out to her. She had just started her own practice.
So Eron's case was one of my very first cases. It was the first case that I filed in the Wayne County Circuit Court under the name Wolf Law. So it's been a long road together for both of us.
The first thing that Rachel did was to sit down and go through Eron's trial transcripts to see if she could uncover a basis for a new trial.
So when I read a trial transcript, I'm looking for all of the things the jury would have been looking at, all the things the prosecutor argued to prove guilt. And in some cases, there is a ton of evidence. You know, there's video evidence, there's DNA evidence, there's multiple eyewitnesses. In this case, we have none of those. There's zero physical evidence in this case. So there are only evidence that Eron was guilty was this testimony of his cousin, Montez Bell. And his testimony itself was about hearsay statements. He said, "Oh, Eron told me that he was there." Eron said, "We're going to take Tone out." So yes, he testified on the stand. I took that to mean they were going to kill him. So the prosecutor's case was an aiding and abetting theory. So they argued throughout that Andre was the shooter. There was never really any question about that. Their argument was that Eron took part in the planning of the operation.
Is that because he said, "We're going to take Tone out"?
Yes. Yes.
Oh my God. Okay.
Which Eron later explained he testified at the evidentiary hearing we had later and explained. He's like, "No, you know, we're going to take Tone out. Like, we're going to go do something. We're going to go to the club," you know, something like that. So the two statements they had that Eron apparently made, that Montez Bell said he made, were both also ambiguous.
Rachel filed a motion for a new trial based on actual innocence ineffective assistance of counsel, and newly discovered evidence. Their investigation had uncovered several new witnesses who testified on Eron's behalf. One was a woman named Jennifer Palmer.
She had had several conversations with Montez Bell in which he admitted that he knew Eron had not been involved, and he knew that Eron wasn't going to be convicted because Eron never had anything to do with it. So direct impeachment evidence against Montez Bell, their main witness.
And there's someone else who testified on Eron's behalf, someone who knows the truth about what happened that day, Andre Rice. Andre, you remember, had gotten a lesser sentence, 25 to 60 years. And thanks to good behavior, he was released after serving less than 25 years of that. And he had already tried to help Eron.
Andre Rice has been out for over a decade. After he was released, he wrote up an affidavit. So when Eron filed his own motion and wrote it himself, it was based on Andre's affidavit. And Andre is also the one that went to the Wayne County Conviction Integrity Unit and said, hey, you know, I know this man is in prison. I'm the one that committed this crime. Please look into this case. The challenge for Andre is that in order to get a new trial, you have to have new evidence.
Since Andre's confession had been presented at the time of trial, it was not considered new evidence when Eron filed his appeal.
If there is a new trial, Andre's testimony can and will be presented at that new trial. And so when the judge is looking at, okay, what's the evidence we're going to have on retrial? Is there a chance that the outcome will be different? She does get to consider what Andre has to say, but his testimony alone was not going to be enough legally for us to argue that Eron was innocent, deserved a new trial. He'd been wrongfully convicted.
Fortunately, when she reviewed the new evidence, Judge Shannon Walker found it credible. And in January of 2023, she vacated Eron's conviction and ordered a new trial. 2 months later, Eron was officially released from prison after nearly 3 decades. Eron soon found work at a chemical plant and got his own apartment. He still has to wear a GPS monitor and stick to a curfew, but he's been enjoying getting to know his 3 adult children and their families.
They were all goobers then when I went to prison. One was barely, 6 months? And that was my youngest son, Aaron, and his sister, Alex, and my oldest son, Xavier. They were like almost 3, 4 when I went to prison. I went in when I was 19 years old. I was a kid. Like, I'm 51 years old now, right? It's crazy sometimes when I look at myself in the mirror and I see my grandfather.
Mm.
Right? Like, I'm gray now and I'm more laid back. And it's just a different experience. You know, I'm looking at life through different lenses.
Unfortunately, Eron's journey isn't over yet. In August of 2023, Wayne County prosecutors appealed the court's decision to grant him a new trial.
What happens in these cases that are 30 years old is that when a new trial is granted, you know, they lose witnesses. Montez Bell is deceased. Antonio Knight's grandmother is no longer available. And what happens is the prosecutor's office is facing the possibility that they won't be able to retry him at all.
But if the court order is reversed and the conviction is reinstated, there's still the possibility that Eron could be sent back.
And it's terrifying. We're terrified. It is extremely likely that they will order Mr. Shellman to report to the Michigan Department of Corrections and go back to incarceration, while we then would need to file another motion for relief from judgment or ask the court to reconsider the issues that she didn't address in her first ruling.
Are you worried about potentially going back?
I'm of the mindset now that if this all turns out to be like a great vacation from what I had been living for almost 31 years, I'm okay with that too. it's in God's hands to me. So I don't stress anymore about it as much as I did early on. And again, I'm thankful for the opportunity to come out and rejoin society at this later stage and get to know my kids and my grandkids in a way that I couldn't from behind those bars, right?
The blessing of having him out alone is just his presence. It's absolutely breathtaking. It's almost like a butterfly, you know, coming from a caterpillar. Yeah. I enjoy watching him pay bills. I enjoy watching him ask about budgets. He enjoys it. He was like, this is a grown-up bill. Look how I got my budget. I just want him to enjoy these things. I don't know anybody. I don't know any other humans who enjoy paying bills.
I'm a big proponent of, you know, I look for the little blessings as much as I look for the big ones, right? You're more likely to stumble across the little ones than the big ones. You sit around and wait for that big one, you know, may not never come, but I'm okay.
You are very graceful. I'm always so shocked that after spending 30 years in a horrible place that you guys are all just so, so graceful and have such humility. You're kind of breaking my heart right now.
No, listen, once you meet me, you kind of can see that, you know, I'm much more than just my case. Right? It's just the truth of the matter. My case happened a very long time ago. I'm sure for that family that, you know, every year is a reminder of that, right? And, you know, it was traumatic. I'm a victim of something, right? But I'm not the victim. I'm just not. The victim isn't here anymore, Maggie. And so I tell people all the time, like, pray for them. Pray for that family.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in the episode description to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our executive producers, Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wordis, as well as senior producer Annie Chelsea, producer Kathleen Fink, story editor Hannah Beal, and researcher Shelby Sorrells. Mixing and sound design are by Jackie Pauly, with additional production by Jeff Clyburn and Connor Hall. The music in this production is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good podcasts in association with Signal Company Number 1.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Rachel Levis, host of the new podcast, Rachel Goes Rogue. This podcast is about choosing my own path and standing in my power. I have been involved with one of the biggest scandals in reality television history. We're going to get into all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly. I've been keeping secrets for far too long, and I just want to come clean. Listen to Rachel Goes Rogue on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jackie Goldschneider from The Real Housewives of New Jersey.
And I'm Jennifer Fessler, also from The Real Housewives of New Jersey.
Welcome to our new podcast,
Two Jersey J's.
We are going to have lots of fun on this podcast while we discuss what it's really like to be a real housewife and all the drama that comes with it.
Follow us as we navigate family, friendships, and even frenemies. Listen to Two Jersey J's on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.